Madeleine Albright never dreamed of becoming Secretary of State. Why would she? She was born in Czechoslovakia, only came to America when her family was forced into exile after the Second World War. Albright married, had children, and then spent much of her time packing lunches and carpooling the kids. But life is full of strange twists of fate. Madeleine Albright talked with Steve Paulson about her life and her memoir, Madam Secretary.
The possibility of having the world's greatest job never occurred to me, and I really didn't start into a full-time career until I was 39 years old and had three children. So I had kind of a stealth career.
So how did you make that transition from mother of three, as you say, didn't have a government job until you were 39, to become the highest-ranking woman in the history of the United States?
Well, I was not idle in the years before I was 39. I graduated from college and got married immediately and had the children. And then I went back to school, and so it took me forever to get a graduate degree. I had a PhD by then, and I had done an awful lot of volunteer work. I worked on school boards, and I worked in politics. And so ultimately, at age 39, I was able to put all those things together and had the honor first to work for Senator Muskie in the Senate, and then a lesson always to my students, be nice to your professors, because then I went to work for Zbigniew Brzezinski, who had been my professor at Columbia when he was National Security Advisor. So I then worked in the Carter White House. And after that, I taught at Georgetown and headed a think tank and worked mostly in a series of losing campaigns, but ultimately got asked by Bill Clinton to go to the United Nations.
Were you very ambitious?
Well, it depends on whether you define that as a good or a bad thing. I think that in women, sometimes it's not supposed to be a good thing. But yes, I wanted to work. I wanted to make a difference.
But there's wanting to work, and then there's becoming Secretary of State. I mean, I guess, did you want to rise to the highest possible levels of government?
Well, it never occurred to me that I could become Secretary of State. First of all, I'd never seen one in a skirt, and I also just did not think that something like that would ever happen. I did want to work in the government. There's no question about that. And I didn't specifically, you know, push people aside in order to rise, but I did want to work in the government.
In your book, you're pretty upfront about what happened to your marriage. Your husband left you for a younger woman. And I guess it raises the question of whether, if you hadn't been divorced, would you have ever become Secretary of State?
I think that if I could have, at the time, persuaded my husband to stay, I would have given up everything to have that happen. On the other hand, I do not think that in my case I would have become Secretary if I had still been married, not because a married woman can't be Secretary of State, but because what I did after what was a very painful period was pull myself together and volunteer for a lot of things, always be available to do whatever anybody asked me to do, initially just to kind of fill the time, and I said, because the ice was so thin, I had to move fast. And then I got very involved in the things I was doing and did, in fact, develop a reputation for getting things done. And I was very glad that I had my PhD in international relations so that I had the right credentials at a time when it was possible to go into the government.
Now, you are the only American woman who's ever served as Secretary of State, and you've written that you actually had more trouble being accepted by men in your own government than by men in other countries, including in rather traditional cultures like Arab cultures. What kinds of comments did you hear from your colleagues in the United States?
Well, you know, what happened was when I went abroad, I represented the United States. It also helped that I arrived in a very large plane that said United States of America on it. And they, whoever they were, knew that they had to deal with me if they were going to have a dialogue with the United States in that particular circumstance. In this country, or in our own government, what happened was that the people that were part of our national security circle were people that I had known a very long time. And all of them actually very nice men, but they had known me in all those previous roles that I told you about, you know, either as a carpool mother or a board chairman or a Hill staffer. And I think it was a little hard for some of them to imagine that all of a sudden I had the number one job in diplomacy. And it wasn't so much anything that they said, and I think every woman listening to you will identify with this, but more kind of a look of, oh my God, there she goes again, or why is she stating that case so stridently, or, you know, what is her business in this? And it's not anything that anybody ever says. It's more kind of an attitude.
So women have to be more careful, or they may worry more about being accused of being strident than men would be.
Well, the thing that happens is the very same qualities in a man and a woman are described by entirely different adjectives. So if a woman cares about a subject, she is called emotional. If a man cares about a subject, he is called committed. If a woman talks loudly, she is aggressive. If a man does, he is bold, you know. So it's that kind of a thing.
Do you have a proudest moment from when you served as Secretary of State?
Yes, I do. And it has a lot to do with the fight against ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. There were a lot of people who questioned whether we should be in Kosovo, whether we should use force in Kosovo. And at the beginning, people called the war in Kosovo Madeleine's War, which was not supposed to be a compliment. A lot of things had gone wrong, most of which I had nothing to do with, like the weather or the fact that our airplanes were not able to hit the targets, or we bombed the Chinese embassy, which was a disaster, an accidental one. But then when we won, I went to Pristina, the capital of Kosovo, and was greeted by huge crowds of people who were cheering and thanking the USA. And now I have been told that there are a lot of little girls in Kosovo whose name is Madeleine.
How do you see the role of U.S. military force in relation to NATO and European military force, and then in relation to the UN? How do those pieces fit together? How should they fit together?
Well, you've asked a very interesting and complicated question. First of all, I do think that the United States is an indispensable power. I said that many times because we are large and powerful and democratic and economically viable with the best military in the world. And I saw in enough of the meetings that I attended that unless the United States made the point or started the discussion or had some initiatives, that a lot of things did not happen. So I did say we were indispensable, but I also never said alone. I believe in NATO and the U.S. role within it. I would have always preferred to have a UN mandate under which to use force. But in Kosovo, for instance, we did have the support of 18 other NATO countries, but we could not get United Nations support for the military action. I didn't think that NATO should have to wait for UN approval because it already was a multilateral organization and showed community consensus. And we went to the UN right after and got an agreement for the United Nations to be able to run the political part of Kosovo. So I believe in American power, but I do not believe that force should be the first resort. And I believe because we have so much power that we need to have some self-control.
Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State. She talked with Steve Paulson about her memoir, Madam Secretary.